Father, you know, we're talking about in these last three chapters now how the paradoxes of Christianity or the eternal revolution. Now, we were talking before the show started about evolution. Now, maybe does Chesterton touch on that at all? And
well, it's interesting that this next chapter is called Revolution. Mm-hmm. It's the same word with an R hooked mm-hmm. onto it, because Chesterton is adamant about pointing out the vacuous words that have slipped into our vocabulary today, words that don't really say anything unless you hook them up with some kind of an object or mm-hmm. a substantive that they are attributed to. We talk about, you know, evolution, the evolution of this and the evolution of that, or education. You know, what we need is more education. Mm-hmm. You know, which says absolutely nothing at all. I mean, it doesn't. What are you going to teach, or who needs to be educated? Educated for what? Mm-hmm. You know, we become comfortable with hearing these words spoken, right. And we bow in reverence when we hear the word said, but we don't think about what it means anymore. What we need is more growth. What we need is more meaning. You know, mm-hmm. what we need is more evolution. Or how do you explain this or that? And you say, well, it evolved. He says that doesn't say anything at all, mm-hmm. unless you talk about evolve from what to what, why, how. Those other questions have to come in. And when Chesterton was writing the first third of this century, that was a time in which the most immature and unbaked sorts of evolutionary interpretation were current and very popular. Mm. And when he was writing, there were people like H.G. Wells writing a whole history of the world, mm-hmm. famous outline of history that was based very much upon evolutionary presuppositions without much thought.
Right.
And so it's interesting that when Chesterton talks about something important, he uses the word revolution. And that brings us here at this point of the book, at the beginning of the last three chapters. We had in the first three chapters his negative critique of the various ways in which we can get mixed up on first principles and not accept the reality of the world as our point of departure in responsible human thought, mm-hmm. the skeptic and the maniac being the two specimens. And then in the next three chapters, The Ethics of Elfland, The Flag of the World, and The Paradoxes of Christianity, he gave us a kind of positive view of how we are to form those principles, showing us in very, very many different ways, kind of shocking ways, stunning ways, enjoyable ways, humorous ways, how the very existence of the universe is for us a gift, something that we cannot work our way to, and that its very giftness, if I can mm-hmm. use that word, demands of us a response of gratitude, and that our first attitude ought to be one of gratitude and one of ready obedience to the demands that our conscience, for example, mm-hmm. imposes. That there is a good to be done, there is an evil to be avoided, and that the universe is a very specific place with its own codes, with its own rules for its operation, and finally with a creator behind it mm-hmm. who imposed those rules upon it and expects us to follow them. And we can only really be happy when we make that initial submission. And only when we've made that initial submission, both of the intellect to the truth of being and the will to mm-hmm. the goodness of being, does everything else become light. As we make that first submission of the mind to the truth of being, we're able to understand other things with a certain clarity. You allow that first bow of the mind to be a bow to something that is like the sun, very splendid but mm-hmm. very unprecise, mm-hmm. then everything else can be clear. And likewise, you make that first bow of the will to the goodness, to the commandments of God, then you're able to enjoy all the other goods. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you insist on starting with clarity and precision in the intellectual sphere, you're going to end up with confusion, which is what we've done in the modern world. But if you start with this splendid blur, as he says, of the sun, you will end up with clarity. If you start with the good, accepting this first good, you'll be able to enjoy mm-hmm. all of the lesser goods. You can enjoy a meal. You can enjoy the procreative powers the Lord has given us if you accept the law of marriage.
Right.
You can enjoy all of these wonderful things, but you first have to make a first submission. If you do not do that, if you want to have your own good first and decide for yourself what the good is, then you're going to end up with all of this unhappiness. which is, of course, the story of the Garden of Eden. And so in these next three these middle three chapters, he is simply showing us the way the world begins to fall into profile, the way it begins to appear to us when we have made that initial act of humility before the creation that God has given us and before God himself. And after the Ethics of Elfland, in which he talks about these conditions that we have to accept without understanding them, in the Flag of the World he gave us the imperative of cosmic patriotism, that we should feel proud of the world, that we should have a certain affection for the universe as God's creation. It's the only one we have, and it's pretty good, as a matter of fact, and we should feel warmly towards it. However, we also notice in the next chapter, Paradoxes of Christianity, that it is a world that is very alive. It's a vibrant world. There are paradoxes in it. There are men and there are women. There is up and there is down. There is here and there is there. There's you and there is me. And he says, what feels right in reality is when we are able to accept both of the terms, not doing what the heretic does, which is to take away one piece and run off with it. He says this happens even in philosophy, even in our natural thought, before revelation, that the temptation is always there to cut off that part of reality which we think we can master with our minds, and then say this is everything. And he says, common sense tries to tolerate both. It even, as he says, a stereoscopic vision. We try to keep both the male and the female, both the feasting and the fasting, both the resting and the activity. We try to keep both going, both intense. That's the common sense view, and he discovered Christianity does the same thing. And so finally now, in the last three chapters, he approaches the question of where, however, in this very vibrant and very startling and very surprising world, where do we find our security? How do we keep ourselves from just going around all the time ooing and awing? I mean, we can't just completely surrender to this astonishment, or we're never going to get anything done. He says, well, there is indeed a very stable center to which we can and should return, around which we must revolve, and for which, in the re-attainment of which, we must ever again start a revolution, he even says. And it must be reborn. We need a renaissance. It must be reformed. We need, in the right sense of the word, a reformation at times. That is, the goal which God has given us, the perfection that he has put before us, is at the end of a long history. He's put us into a story, and we have to make decisions. And he says we must understand the world that God created was not a machine that he designed, which many modern philosophers, particularly the earlier ones, urged us to believe, that the world is a kind of perfectly designed machine that's been wound up in just the right way and has been programmed in just the right way, like a computer. And all we need to do is learn what those laws are and follow them. He said, that's not the way reality is. If you study mathematics, you can get that impression. But you don't start the world with mathematics, you start the world with the world. This is not a world, but rather the material for a world. God has given us not so much the colors of a picture as the colors of a palette. But he has also given us a subject, a model, a fixed vision. We must be clear about what we want to paint. This adds a further principle to our previous list of principles. We have said we must be fond of the world even in order to change it. We now add that we must be fond of another world in order to have something to change it to. That is, God has given us the materials of this world, this wild world, this interesting world, this dangerous world, but he has also given us the challenge to make something out of it, to do something with it. We have to act. We don't just sit and contemplate it. We have to go out and do things with it. We have to contemplate something too. But what he's saying here is, if you are not contemplating the something that is fixed, you will not have anything to change the world to. He gives the example of the painter Whistler. Here on page 108 of the image edition. Our first requirement about the ideal towards which progress is directed, it must be fixed. That's another one of those nonsense words that means nothing if you don't have an object. Progress. What we need is progress. Well, progress towards a cliff that you're going to fall over is not isn't a good thing. I mean, right. Progress depends on what are you progressing towards. Mm-hmm. Whistler used to make many rapid studies of a sitter. Somebody was sitting for him to make a portrait. Whistler used to make many rapid studies of a sitter. It did not matter if he tore up 20 portraits, but it would matter if he looked up 20 times and each time saw a new person sitting placidly for his portrait.
That's right.
That is, if we're going to change the world and progress it, we must have some fixed vision. If you're constantly changing the vision, mm-hmm. you can't progress. Progress is impossible.
You can see how practical he is, though. I mean, you know, he just gets down to the common sense of it. You know, it's
very practical. Yeah. This is something even the common sense man sees, and he discovers also his first principles and his moral laws. Revelation, Christian revelation, simply comes down and confirms this mm-hmm. and adds the supernatural dimension to it. That is, we are on a road, and it is a road that is going somewhere. And we have been given a task to realize something. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have a clear idea of it, a fixed notion of what it is, the truth, truth that doesn't change, a goodness that doesn't change, a goodness that is worth realization for its own sake, mm-hmm. not because of something else. If we don't have those things clear, we can't even have a revolution. Mm-hmm. We can't even have the fun of rebellion, he says, if we don't have a rule that we are constantly returning to. And so, it doesn't have an integer, doesn't have an integrating mm-hmm. Orientation. He says here, to the Orthodox, once again, this is always the theme of orthodoxy mm-hmm. that keeps penetrating through. To the Orthodox, there must always be a case for revolution. For in the hearts of men, God has been put under the feet of Satan. In the upper world, hell once rebelled against heaven. But in this world, heaven is rebelling against hell. For the Orthodox, there can always be a revolution, for revolution is a restoration. That is, the church is a militial society. This is the, we don't call this the, the weekend church or the Sunday church. This is the military church. Mm-hmm. We are the church militant. Right. And that means we're fighting. And this is something you have to say to the people today, because mm-hmm. we've gotten into the idea that the church has to do with peace, that the church has to do with abolishing war, that the Christian message is essentially pacifistic. If the Christian message is pacifistic, it's not the Christian message.
It's amazing, because when you read that scripture, Christ said, "I didn't come for peace," but he wanted to be first. If he's not first, and otherwise,
right. That's another,
this
that's,
is the struggle.
That's
yeah.
another example.
Yeah.
War, you'll hear that talked about, or peace, without an object.
Mm-hmm.
The evil of war. Well, it depends upon what you're fighting about.
Yeah, right.
If I'm fighting for my salvation, war is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm fighting just to extend my property rights, it's an evil thing.
That's right.
It's a humor that is it's wed with the argument. It's not
right.
It's not like pepper or sugar that's put on top just to spice mm-hmm. it up. Mm-hmm. Like people throwing
it
jokes.
Illustrates it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not
yeah.
a joke that's thrown in. It arises right out of it, because there really is. I mean, Dante wrote his great panorama of the whole Christian universe. And he didn't entitle it The Divine Tragedy, he called it The Divine Comedy, because there's going to be a happy ending. And Chesterton knows that, and he sees that, and people think that he's frivolous sometimes, or flippant, because mm-hmm. he talks in this way. He's not more serious and grave about it, but he says, "I'm most serious when I'm most funny." That's the most serious things are the funny things, and a joke is a very intellectual affair. A joke completely fails if you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to see it with the mind. And then you start laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, "You don't see it yet, do you? Because you're not laughing." It's a matter of the mind.
This chapter on the romance of orthodoxy. What is?
Well, he builds up to that, because mm-hmm. his eternal revolution right here at the end. He comes once again to one of these three concepts that we mentioned in the last show: creation, person, and freedom. In this particular case, I could never conceive or tolerate any utopia which did not leave me the liberty for which I chiefly care, the liberty to bind myself. Complete anarchy would not merely make it impossible to have any discipline or fidelity, it would also make it impossible to have any fun. To take an obvious instance, it would not be worthwhile to bet if a bet were not binding. The dissolution of all contracts would not only ruin morality, but spoil sport. Now, betting and such sports are only the stunted and twisted shapes of the original instinct of man for adventure and romance. And the perils, rewards, punishments, and fulfillments of an adventure must be real if the adventure is only a shifting and heartless nightmare. If I bet, I must be made to pay, or there is no poetry in betting. If I challenge, I must be made to fight, or there is no poetry in challenging. If I vow to be faithful, I must be cursed when I am unfaithful, or there is no fun in vowing. For the purpose even of the wildest romance, results must be real, results must be irrevocable. That is the idea we have today of freedom is really often the idea of license.
That's right.
It's simply being a servant of your own will, which is not freedom at all. Being a slave to your own will and appetites is the worst kind of slavery at all. And the real freedom is the freedom to bind yourself to a higher will, the will of God.
And I think this is one of the things that we have to realize, that God takes commitments seriously.
If you're not going to be serious about it, don't make it. But you're going to lose something if you don't. And what you're going to lose is precisely the subject of the next chapter. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose romance. Mm-hmm. I mean, in married life, it's obvious. A real love, a real romance between a man and a woman is based upon that commitment. Mm-hmm. That's what they say to each other forever and ever. You know, nothing will part us until death do us part. Mm-hmm. That's the way you express the deepest love. You're saying, I'm going to fix my will on this high good, which is you, right now, and our family, until death do us part. Or in the religious life, you're making it with the Lord. In a very direct way, or any commitment that you make. It turns your life into a romance. You've committed yourself to something, and you can have adventures now.